And now we're speaking with Murray Dobbin. And for the longest time I've been waiting to conduct this interview, I read his article, Why Not Talk About Work, back in December, just before our program took a hiatus. And Murray's article was about the deteriorating conditions of work and life in Canada. And the reason we're talking about it here today is because it simply isn't being discussed on any of the larger channels. So that's why we have Murray with us, and I want to thank you very much, Murray, for coming on the program today.
Oh, happy to be here.
Well, it's just like you said, right? You find bits and pieces of the story on CBC, Global, Globe and Mail, but not the whole story. You know, I, like you, have caught the odd story about workplace stress or work-life balance, youth unemployment. They come up in bursts, fits, whatever, but no one's talking about the big picture. And the big picture is one of decline for most Canadians, isn't it? I mean, what can you tell us about some of the broad trends that have been happening?
Well, I mean, it really started to happen seriously after the Free Trade Agreement, which, of course, was not free, wasn't about trade, and it certainly wasn't free. It was more about all these agreements that are called Free Trade Agreements are really corporate rights agreements, and they allow corporations to move jobs away without any sort of penalty. It used to be that you had conditions where you set up a factory, you couldn't simply, move 1,000 jobs to Alabama, without paying a price. So it really started in the 1980s with the advent of globalization. And one of the things that I've noticed and have repeated numerous times in things I've written is that in the 70s and even into the early 80s, the economy was supposed to serve communities and supposed to serve people. I mean, it was, all the political parties, conservative, NDP, liberal, paid a lot of attention to unemployment, or at least paid lip service to it. But you began to see in the 1980s that suddenly it was, what could you do for the economy? what could ordinary people do for the economy rather than what the economy could do for them? And that was a huge cultural shift. It didn't happen overnight, but it happened gradually. And now it's just, that's what you always hear, is it good for the economy? But if you dig down a bit, the economy means corporations. It doesn't mean communities. It doesn't mean families. When you talk about the economy, it's really a euphemism for what's good for corporations. And that's really what we've been seeing for almost the last 30 years.
Well, I have to agree. I remember Linda McQuaig saying something very similar. Everyone's saying we have to make sacrifices for the economy, like it's some kind of terrible god. And we let ourselves be bossed around. And as you say, this is being done for corporate benefit. The implications for ordinary Canadians have become increasingly clear. You've pointed out we're increasingly a low-wage workforce in Canada. People have high debt levels. And I think, in particular, we're working hundreds of extra hours compared to many of our OECD counterparts. Overall, it feels like we're giving things up. We had a 10-hour day. We had a big battle for the 10-hour day back in the 19th century to reduce the workday to 10 hours. And we eventually got it down to 9 hours and even 8 hours in many standard arrangements. But now what? We're back up to 10 or 12 hours?
Well, yeah. I mean, something like 68% of Canadian workers work more than 45 hours a week. And the typical employee in Canada now works 50.2 hours. So we're back to, we're long past the time when we had the 8-hour day, and a lot of this, not only that, but a lot of this work is unpaid overtime. Our labor standards, we still have labor standards on the books, but governments have increasingly cut the enforcement of those labor standards. Employees are terrified of quitting jobs because now UI has also been gutted. It used to be that 75% of people who paid into unemployment insurance were eligible to receive it. That's now down to something like 37%. So two-thirds of people who pay into this fund never qualify for it. So people, it used to be that you could quit a job if the employer was abusing you and get unemployment insurance. Now you can't. And so what we've seen is a dramatic decrease in the power of labor to represent ordinary people. So this is this has been going on for a very long time, and as a result, employers now feel quite at ease exploiting people and saying, well, if you really want the job, then you'll work on Saturday for 5 hours for nothing. This is a huge change from the time in the 1960s and 70s when something like, 65% of private sector workers were organized.
And that must be the connection there. I don't think there was any collective decision to work longer hours or get paid less or take on more debt. So, I mean, this is something that has been forced onto people. And you've been monitoring the situation for a while. You referred to a study by Higgins and Duxbury. That was actually in 2001, and it arrived at similar conclusions. If you've taken a labor studies course in Ontario or the rest of Canada, even at the beginning of this decade, you probably were learning that work was precarious and low-paying, people being asked to take safety risks or work unpaid overtime. And that was 10 years ago. So I guess we've been in a rapid slide for more than a decade.
Oh, yeah. I think we've been in a slide really since the late 80s, really, I think, since the Free Trade Agreement. That's when corporations were given the enormous amount of power. And it's also, if you look at the record of Paul Martin when he was finance minister, one of the things he did during the 1990s was implement a really ferocious policy. I mean, the euphemism is labor flexibility, but of course, if you dig down into that, that simply means, a radical shift in the balance of power between capital and labor. One of the things he did was, and people don't remember this, they think the 90s was a good decade. The 90s, the average unemployment throughout the 1990s was between 8 and 9%, and it was deliberately held at that level by much higher interest rates than were necessary. They had an inflation target of something like 1.5%, which is just ludicrous. Even the IMF said that you can have an inflation rate of up to 6 or 7% without damaging the economy. So the whole purpose of keeping inflation at 1.5% had little to do with inflation. Had a great deal to do with punishing labor and creating high unemployment so that workers were more vulnerable. At the same time, of course, they cut UI, as I referred to earlier. And the third thing that Paul Martin did was he removed the federal government from any influence on social assistance. They used to have a major role in social assistance and transferred funds to the provinces on the condition that they be spent in certain ways. And, of course, Paul Martin just eliminated that. So, within a few years, virtually all the provinces had cut welfare rates by 20 to 30 to even 40%. So the prospect of leaving a bad job is pretty scary. If you can't qualify for UI and you're looking at trying to live on $500 a month on welfare, then you stick with a bad job because the choice, the alternative is even worse.
No, they don't want there to be very many good alternatives, and it's not like you can just leave the job you're working at if you're dissatisfied, walk across the street and get hired. Those days have long passed. And it is about removing alternatives. I remember reading in the 1980s, you had people working for the government saying that the rise in the unemployment rate from, say, 3% to 5% to 7 or 8% is acceptable. So they redefined what an acceptable unemployment rate was. Back in the Keynesian era in the 60s and 70s, they were trying to keep it at 3 or 5%. And then the government starts saying, well, it's okay to have it higher. That has a disciplining effect on the labor force. And I think you've just explained what that disciplining effect is.
Oh, yeah. It's just to completely remove the power of the power of workers. And, I think the other factor of this, of course, is that I think the labor movement has been asleep at the switch for a long time on this and has not really grasped the impact of some of these policies. And I think they're beginning now, I think, with the merger of the CEP and the CAW and some of the innovative ideas that they're talking about, where they will actually begin to have a sort of associate membership in the union of workers who have been laid off. So I think that unions need to figure this out, and I think one of the things that they need to figure out is that you need to engage people at a community level and not just a workplace level. Because it used to be, the typical workplace, you might have, especially in Ontario and in parts of Quebec, you'd have 1,000 workers at a workplace. When we were an industrial country. Well, we're not an industrial country anymore, and so workplaces have changed, and unions have to really figure this out if they want to survive. In the United States, of course, I think the private sector level of unionization is down to something like 5%. I mean, it's appalling. Canada's a little better than that, but, you know, it's mostly our public sector workers who are organized. You know, the vast majority of people now in the private sector are not protected by unions, and they're not even protected by labor standards, as I said earlier, because governments have cut back on the enforcement of those things.
Well, it's really interesting, the choices available to unions. We know unions have limited resources, so they tend to focus on their primary interest, delivering certain wage increases or benefit packages to their membership. But to survive today in the current environment of globalization, obviously new strategies are required. And we've seen some positive developments. You mentioned ideas with the CAWCEP merger, and there's all sorts of new strategies being conducted. In the United States, for example, the private sector low-wage service growth is probably the dominant area right now in employment. And so Walmart, there's been attempts to unionize Walmart workers for a while, but finally they're starting to get some play. Say late last year and early into this year, there's been campaigns like Our Walmart, where they're not just creating a union, but they're creating worker organizations that represent workers in whatever way they can, because Walmart has become so good at smashing standard union organizing efforts. So they have an alternate strategy as well, which is to gather workers under the Our Walmart banner, and they can be represented in that way. But you also have standard unionization drives with McDonald's workers and other sectors. So we're starting to see a picking up of that low-wage work, which is becoming the dominant area of the economy now.
Oh yeah, no, I think there's some exciting stuff going on in the U.S., and there was a big cross-company strike in New York, where you know the thousands of workers in the fast food industry had a one-day strike. So I'm really encouraged by that sort of thing, and I hope it spreads into Canada. I mean, there have been efforts to organize Walmart in Canada, but of course they've been, like you say, they've been quite vicious. I mean, I think in Quebec they just closed the store when workers were able to get a vote in favor of the union. So it's, you know, these are really hard fights, and of course, you know, people are faced with shopping at Walmart because it is a cheap place to shop, but people, you know, and people, even people who shop there may realize that the reason it's cheap is that they exploit their workers and exploit workers overseas. On the other hand, if you're barely making a living, then you don't have a choice not to shop at Walmart.
Well, Walmart, we see they tend to cut off the stores or the areas that unionize. So they did that here in Canada. They just try to close it down. Or in the United States, they stopped using suppliers that were unionizing. But there were still successes among those supply workers. I mean, they managed to get unpaid wages paid back to them and things like that. It's starting to work. And what we see now is that unions have to reflect the economy and the workforce that currently exists. You know, unions were formed to deal with an industrial workforce, as you point out, in Canada and the United States. As it changes and it employs new demographics, unions can change just like businesses change, because the businesses figured out how to game the system with regard to, you know, Walmart drive. So the unions, they can change to reflect the new realities as well.
Yeah, and I think the other thing is the need for legislation. I mean, you could form legislation that would simply make it illegal to close down a store because its members have unionized. So there needs to be a revisiting of the role of the state in this, and I think that's one of the other things that unions can do, is really start to expose governments for their refusal to enforce labor standards. I mean, it's supposedly on the books, it's against the law to force someone to work overtime for no pay. I mean, that's outrageous. I mean, 25 years ago, any company, any employer doing that would have been on the front page of a newspaper. Now it's commonplace, and I think that's one of the things that unions could do too, is to begin a campaign to re-implement some of these labor standards and to assist workers in terms of the knowledge of what their rights actually are. Now, I'm sure there are hundreds of thousands of workers out there who have no idea what the labor standards are and what their rights are in the workplace.
Yes, figuring out how to get political representation or union party arrangements, there's all sorts of questions that have to be answered in strategies. And as you pointed out, I want to bring attention to this. You indicated that this is about power, that employers have much more power than they used to. Corporations in general have so much power. That's why they're able to influence government, influence legislation, close down stores that are unionizing, ask for unpaid overtime, and so on. And What you're doing is you're connecting the dots over what's been happening in the last two or three decades. That's why we appreciate interviewing you here, because on the newspapers, you just get a slice of the story every now and then. And you've shown that long-term aspect. And what isn't being talked about in the big picture is work itself. And I think that's what your article, Why Not Talk About Work, really succeeds in doing. And it shows work is the central factor in our lives. You know, we spend, if your article is correct, then we spend more time at work than with our own families. And it means that it's the most important part of so many people's lives. They're even avoiding having children because of work. Yeah. But you don't see it very much. There's interesting sports, drama, and a few inventions, you know, by members of the community that are highlighted in the newspaper. TV shows show exciting jobs like CSI, but no one's talking about the daily slog, the mundane work. You know, it's really the hidden abode of production. And so without that, we can't see how people's entire lives are being affected by changes in the workplace.
Well, and I mean, and these aren't jobs like we used to have. I mean, I think it's now 70%. I was just looking at some figures on the middle class, and it used to be in the 60s and 70s, 30% of middle class families needed to have two incomes to maintain that middle class status. It's now 70%. So, I mean, the whole notion of having a middle-class standard of living means you not only do you have to have two jobs, but you have to go 160% of your annual income in debt in order to maintain that lifestyle. And there were some recent interesting figures about incredible job insecurity and how most people have very little job security. And lastly, you mentioned the family life. I mean, one of the studies by Duxbury and her partner showed that, you know, if you looking at the 30,000 or so workers that they interviewed, the vast majority said they had virtually no family life at all, because these are not necessarily 9-to-5 jobs. I mean, these are part-time jobs. They're shift jobs. I mean, a couple might have 4 jobs in order to maintain the kind of lifestyle that people had with a single job in 1970.
Yeah, no, you pretty much summed it up when you said that Canadians are not making more Canadians.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, people are postponing having children, or they're not having children at all because they simply can't afford to do it. I mean, our birth rate has been dropping steadily over the last 20 years. Which is why we, have to bring in 260,000 immigrants a year. I mean, I certainly don't. I'm not opposed to immigration, but it's just part of the race to the bottom. Those immigrants would prefer to live in their own countries if they could make a decent wage, and they come to Canada because they can get higher wages here. But it's craziness in terms of workers, no matter where they are, whether they're in Canada or in Bangladesh. I mean, they are under the same sorts of pressure from corporate globalization.
Well, that's right. If we create insecurity abroad, it leads to insecurity here as well. And I think underlying some of this is the fact that Canadian employers seem to prefer importing labor rather than training labor. So they want to import trained labor or whatever they can get rather than paying the cost to train.
Oh, well, Canadian business is absolutely appalling and notorious for its refusal to invest in its own employees, to invest in new, in more effective management, in technology. It has been so accustomed to just being able to ship stuff over the border into the U.S. That it's completely risk averse. We have one of the worst records in terms of productivity of any country in the developed Western world, and it's because our corporate leaders are so inept and have been at the public trough for so long that, the way they increase their profits is to get tax cuts. But now they're paying the price for that now, because the U.S. market is not as robust as it used to be, and they're suddenly having to wake up and look for other markets. But it's going to be a long time.
Yeah.
And I don't see, American or Canadian corporations anytime soon understanding that if you want a strong economy, you have to have a high wage economy, and it'll be a long time before that sinks in. And of course, you've got governments like the Harper government and the Liberal government under Paul Martin, who pushed hard as they could for a low wage economy, and now they're paying the price because because trade is no longer feeding the Canadian economy the way it used to be. And what we now have is a domestic economy that's suffering from all of these policies. And so you have no backup when the trade economy begins to collapse.
And now we see this on a crazy scale at even Walmart, where we've seen internal discussion in Walmart that says they're eroding their own customer base, that they don't understand why people can't afford to buy Walmart products anymore. But of course, we know the effects on communities and the fact that they encourage their employees to go on state welfare because the wages are so low. So
yes, they need to revisit Henry Ford, who realized when he was making his cars that he wasn't selling very many, and he looked at his own workforce and he realized that he wasn't paying them enough to afford a car, so he doubled their wages. And it wasn't because he was a nice guy. He was in other ways an appalling industrialist, very much the same as the rest of them. But he understood that people have to have enough money to buy the stuff they're making. And that whole concept of Fordism has died in the last 20 years, and it might be time to revisit it.
Yeah, I guess we've really regressed. You know, they said they were bringing us a new economy in the 90s. I guess what they meant was the 1890s, and that's what they brought us to.
Yeah, I'm afraid so.
Well, anyhow, you know the story, and I mean, you've been writing about that, and I think we're going to see more in the Taiyi and possibly other publications on the conditions of work and life in Canada. And we do have some developments that are positive to look forward to. We have seen the organizing at Walmart. We have seen walkouts by McDonald's workers. We've seen protests by McDonald's guest workers that were imported,
right.
You know, and other places too. So the unions are looking at new strategies. We see low-wage employees fighting back. So there are things that we can do. And I know that if they do happen, you'll be keeping track of them. So thanks so much for writing on this and for being on the program. People can tune in and on the internet to the Taiyi, and they can catch articles. Do you have a blog or any other publications you would encourage people to look at?
Well, I mean, my column also appears in Rabble, and Rabble's, I think, a very good online publication as well. I have a blog, but it hasn't been very active lately, so I'm sticking mostly to my column.
Excellent. Well, okay. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks, Brendan.